As I didn't say before, apologize that Rod isn't here for those who came to see him. And also, this goes for today and also all our other Dharma talks. It's in the spirit of Buddhism that you don't have to stay for the full two hours of the talk. It really is up to you. The door is always open. Don't feel awkward that you have to get up and walk in front of everyone, because that's how Buddhism is. The Buddha invited everyone to come and see. So for any Buddhist event, if you feel compelled to stay, then either revise where you go to for your events, or just look inside and see whether this feeling is coming from your own thoughts, or is it actually real? Is it what is compelling you to have this awkwardness? Okay, so let's talk about the power of speech. Actually, does anyone have any questions about the meditation that we just did? Was it all right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'm going to start by drawing on the board.
So this is what I think speech fits into Buddhism. This is how important the practice of speech is. Would anyone like to guess what I'm trying to draw?
Noble Eightfold Path.
Yes, the Noble Eightfold Path. So we'll have right view, thoughts, actions, they all have right in front of it, or skillful. So the noble Eightfold Path, as you may or may not know, is the Buddha's advice on the path to enlightenment. So it is at the center of Buddhism, and it's the fourth noble truth, the truth of the way leading to the end of suffering. So the four noble truths, the Buddha started by saying there is suffering in the world. It's not your suffering, my suffering, or our suffering, but suffering is a truth. That's what he stated it as. But he didn't just say there is suffering and leave it at that. He said there is a cause to suffering, there is the end of suffering, and there is a path leading to the end of suffering. And the path is the Noble Eightfold Path. And speech is one of the branches of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it is, if you want to see how important the practice of speech is in Buddhism, it's one of the things that must be practiced to get to enlightenment. So, what are the factors of right speech? Would anyone like to guess? From your own experience, in what way do we need to speak to that leads to peace and harmony, rather than the other way? Which is why I'm sure we're all here for.
Don't say bad things about people.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, don't say bad thing. You can also say it's not to gossip, isn't it? Yeah.
Yep, so avoiding gossip?
But is there a difference between bad things and criticism that doesn't necessarily have to be taken negatively, but yeah, it can be constructive criticism?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, definitely. Because
then what
For example, do you mean like constructive criticism or feedback?
Just like thinking critically about people, is that can you do that in a way that's not kind of
bad?
Yeah.
Can I go back to the definition of right here?
Yeah.
So right in the Noble Eightfold Path, each of these have a right in front of it. I just wrote it for the first one. In short, it's something that doesn't harm ourselves and doesn't harm others. So it applies for speech as well. So when we have speech, whether we say it out loud, whether we think it to ourselves, whether we think directed to others, I think the most skillful method of seeing whether this is right speech or not right speech, whether it's skillful or not, is to ask ourselves very honestly whether this brings harm to anyone or brings harm to ourselves. So, and this includes self-talk as well, which is a very big part of speech, because before we say things out, we say it to ourselves. And even if we're not saying things out, we're saying things to ourselves all the time. And how do we know whether it will bring harm or not? Very, very often, because our mind is so filled with things, it's hard to see. We might think something might be beneficial on the short term, but in the long term, it might breed negative habits. Or, so the best way to see it is to quieten the mind and see what comes up when we do something.
And I think also comes back to your honesty, to your own intention, because every action will have underlying, every action that we do have underlying intention behind it. So it's also good to be very, very honest to ourselves why we're doing things, why we say things, why we think things the way we think. For example, like when we criticize others, we need to check why. What is making us to compel to say or to criticize others? Is it to make us feel good about ourselves? Is it to make, you know, to boost this ego? Or is it just to undermine our insecurity or something like that? So it's good to check why we're doing things, and in that way we can know what is harmful and what is not harmful.
Did that kind of answer
your
question? Okay, cool.
Continue on with right speech.
Yes, where is that up to?
What's our right speech?
What consists of right speech?
Lying.
Yep. Avoiding. Oh, we had avoiding gossip, avoiding lying. Anyone else?
Harsh speech.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Harsh speech, and
empty talk. Idle
or empty speech. Mm. So those are the four unskillful ways of using speech that the Buddha advised against. Let's start with the lying, so dishonest speech. Lying is one of the five, have you heard of the five precepts?
Yes.
So
the five precepts is basically the morality practice in Buddhism. So we've got five training. The first one is not harming, living the life of others, so basically not killing. The second one is not stealing, or not taking any possessions of others that is not given to you. The third one is not lying, or not speaking of a lie. Yeah, well, basically it's the same thing. The fourth one, sexual misconduct. I think that's the third one, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mixed up the third and the fourth. The third one is sexual misconduct. Basically it's saying that you're not doing something that is not skillful towards others' partners, or Or if you have a partner, you don't sleep around, kind of thing. Or you don't harass sexually of others, to others. And the fourth one was, I was saying about not lying. And the fifth one is not taking intoxicants. So they are just the moral practice of in Buddhism. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Please interrupt me whenever you feel. Okay, so the moral practices are what I said. Actually, I did mention it before. They're based around... they weren't thought up by the Buddha because he felt like thinking up rules for Buddhists. They're based on the principle of not harming yourself and not harming others. So if you look at morality deeply, that's where it comes from. And if we go back to speech, has anyone not told a lie before? No, I know I have told lies, so I'm pretty sure it's quite natural for people to tell lies. But that's why it's a point of practice. And we can see that lying... We must think of why do people lie? Let's think of it that way.
Well, you know how we talk about white lies?
Yeah.
Because it's like you think that if you're going to tell the truth, then that's going to be hurtful to the other person.
Yeah.
So you tell a lie because that's going to prevent harm to them. You think in that instance. But, I don't know. I guess I don't really know what the long-term...
Yeah, I think...
White lies are.
I agree. Like, as a child, I used to lie to my parents a lot. Because...
Your parents can listen to this?
Perhaps. And going back to the reason why... Well, I thought that it would be beneficial to... Well, myself, first of all, so I wouldn't get in trouble or punished and wouldn't hurt my parents. So those are the two things of, you know, why would I want to see my parents angry? So I'll tell a lie to, you know, not have that. Is that bad or not? And now that I think about it, a lot of the times why we lie is because it's a conditioned reaction to the fear of being punished. So, for example, kids will lie because they don't want to be punished, because they know they've done something wrong. And the reason why they would say, no, I didn't do that, no, it wasn't me, is because they have this idea of, if I tell the truth, I'll get in trouble. And this is something that's very, very...
Instinctive?
Very instinctive, yeah. Like, for example, for kids in the classroom with their teacher. And because I teach kids once a week, so I deal with kids quite a lot. And they might do something, and then they think you haven't seen it, but then when you catch them, they'll say, no, I didn't do it. No, it was this, it was that. Like, come up with any excuse except to say, okay, I did it, I did something wrong, and I'll fix it. And I think this is a conditioned reaction of fear of punishment. And that comes from the idea that if we do something wrong, we have to be punished. So Jack, I'll get back to you. Perhaps encouraging honesty firstly comes with the idea of removing the idea of punishment. So, for example, in a family, if the parents were to say, openly admit mistakes, it goes both ways. So adults make mistakes as well. So, yeah. Bring up children in a way that encourages admitting, accepting mistakes and learning from them, mm-hmm. instead of did a mistake, this is wrong, and then going the negative way. Maybe that would encourage more truth in society as a whole. I'm making very big statements here, but hope they're not statements, they're just ideas. Jack, did you have something to say?
Just to exaggerate the case, say, for example, in terms of, like, this is just for discussion, right? So, say, for example, the Earth was attacked by alien, and only the government knows about this. And to not cause world chaos, they lie to the people that everything is okay, and that flying saucer that some people supposedly saw in the sky is just fake.
Did you watch Transformers recently?
So,
So the question is?
So the question is, in terms of this, say, in terms of this particular scenario, in terms of lying, how would it apply? Like, thoughts. I'm just putting it on the table.
Yeah.
It's a scenario.
Why is it bad?
If you lie, then world. If you lie, then everyone's okay, and there wouldn't be chaos. Immediate chaos. There might be chaos after, but there wouldn't be immediate chaos. Or if you don't lie, then there'll be immediate chaos, and maybe no possible, either possible or no possible way to tackle it because everyone's chaotic.
Do you want to try?
I don't know.
Okay. Don't worry then.
Can I try?
Yeah.
Well, in a way, I have no idea how to manage a country, so I wouldn't speak in terms of a country because I wouldn't know what's the aspect that I need to take into account for. But if I scale it down to just an individual level, so let's say, for example, just now you mentioned about the white lie, but what happens when the white lie, like when the truth comes out? Would that person feel better or worse when you found out that you lied to them? So I'll assume most of the time it would be worse, but it depends on the individual and it depends on the situation as well. But then there's also the concept of us being afraid that lie might be found out. So the constant worry, oh, I told that lie to this person, and then I told another lie to this person. So when will they find out that I've lied to them? Or so what happens is it creates a lot of problem for yourself. So it might be easier if you don't lie and just tell the truth. And then you, in a way, you don't need to keep track of what lie have you told this person that I need to. Sometimes you might need to make another lie to cover your first lie. So you'll be adding on a lot of lies on the first lie. And then if you tell someone this lie and then you tell the other another lie, you have to keep track of a lot of things. And I would just think that it creates a lot of trouble for yourself. And then regarding the country, we'll leave it there.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Regarding white lies, because what I understand of white lies, that it's different from lies and white lies, because white lies, it defines you're omitting something out. Like, actually, is that wrong? By not, because I think not disclosing the truth and lying is different.
Correct.
Because
I was about,
you're not creating something that is fiction.
Yeah, I was about to mention also another way when you're stuck in a situation where if you say the truth, it might harm another person. The best way is sometimes not to say anything. Or to deflect the question. That's part of life, right? We need to find what's skillful in particular situation. So if you find that telling the truth might cause more problem, then maybe best not to say anything. Or even try to ask the other person question that makes the other person think in a different perspective. One example. And with white lie, So how I was mentioning about you saying that omitting,
yeah.
Not quite sure where you're getting at, but probably how I got it is that you're saying that by not,
yeah,
saying,
by not saying
the truth, yeah, but at the same time you're not telling any lie.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's a lie then. It's not even a white lie. I think how we say white lie is that, for example, when somebody asks, do I look fat in it? And then you're like, you don't want to upset the other person. You just say, no, no, you look perfect. But in your mind, you're thinking, oh, that is so fat. You know what I mean? Yes, that is white lie example.
Okay.
So that is what we call normally white lie. But you can just simply, if somebody's, if you think that's fat, and if you say it's fat, she's going to be upset. And you just smile. It's subjective. Or you can say something like that, you know. You don't have to answer the question. That's the point.
I have my answer now.
Yeah, now you know how to answer.
So with lies, you're saying the power of speech is silence.
Can be, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. If the situation is better for you, for us to be silent, then silence is the answer.
Yeah, actually, in speech, when we talk about how do you write speech, we often think of, oh, what do I say or what do not to say. But the first step of speech is whether or not to speak, which is the choice of silence or speaking, which is also very important. That's just what Rosie was talking about, I think. Yeah, we should remember, not just with speech, but with all the other actions and thoughts. All the other actions, I mean. There's the choice. But the first choice of all is whether or not to do or to speak.
I think it's good to experience that, though, because you experience it and do it and then learn always from it.
Yeah, so you don't repeat.
So I think it's good for each one of us to have mind at some stage. Then...
I'm pretty sure.
Carry on from there.
I'm pretty sure everyone had lied before. I'm pretty sure.
I would hate to think that we didn't.
I'd like to meet someone who's never lied before.
Yeah, me too. Let me know if you meet this person.
A baby.
Is it because they can't speak yet? They pretend to cry.
We're all born pure. That's how we decided to walk along the line.
Okay.
So where were we? Not lying.
No, that was love's lying.
Mm-hmm. Second one, divisive speech.
Divisive speech.
Gossip.
Gossip. We can see how much damage gossip has done. I think we've all studied history, right? Just looking at... Oh, yes, Ricky Lee.
I'm just wondering what gossip is. Like, what's the definition here?
It's something that divides people. Divisive. Would you like to explain?
Basically, well, in the more formal way of explaining that part is divisive speech. So what it means is that speech that is having a potential to divide people. So when you gossip about somebody, you normally tell another person a bad thing about the other person, right? So it's like dividing people. So there is this kind of division among people. That is why gossip is one example of divisive speech. Because you don't gossip people when you read the magazine, right? There's nothing positive about it. It's normally about, you know, so-and-so having an affair with the other person or, you know, that kind of gossip is never a good thing. So that is what I think is considered gossip. So if it's something good about others, I wouldn't call it as a gossip. Probably it's just maybe you can break it news kind of thing. Yeah, but gossip is normally something bad about others.
So it's no taste, it's tasteless.
Mm.
There is speech that doesn't fall into, you know, right or not right. For example, can I have a cup of tea, please? It's not really... Yeah.
You want? I can get you one.
would it, in that case, wouldn't it be more about
about the way that you're saying it and like the intention, like you were saying before, like if you said, give me a cup of tea, please. That's like a little bit less bright than give me a cup of tea, please.
Yeah, definitely. Did the gossip, was your gossip question answered?
Yeah.
Was that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
I just want to say that if, because what happened to me is like, I used to call my grandmother quite frequently, and so I find that she actually enjoys like listening to gossip, so since she's alone at home, so what I would do is I would tell something like I'll tell her something about something bad about others, like just to
spice things up.
Not spice things up. I mean, her life can be pretty boring, so I find that telling her gossip makes her life more interesting. And she's if she enjoys doing that and she's happy after all this talk. Should I continue then?
What's your intention when you speak to her?
My intention is just to keep her
entertaining.
Entertained, yeah.
Because
she's alone at home, so that's my intention. But I know it's bad.
Yeah.
So, but if she enjoys and she's happy after that, I think it's a bit selfish, but I think it's alright.
I think you have the answer, because if you reflect, right, in Buddhism we do a lot of self-reflection. So with your own action, for example, when you speak to your grandma, you talk about others, blah, 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 reflect to yourself. How do you feel after that?
At first I feel bad for
feeling
bad for people, but when I know that she's happy, then I kind of...
That is a very interesting, because this is how the mind works, right? When you've done something like that and you feel bad, and then you justify your feeling with something else that make you feel better, that is just how the mind works. So let's say that's what when we say very honest with yourself, that this is what it means, right? When you're very honest with yourself, when you see that you're actually feeling bad, stop it there. You are actually feeling bad. And then what you do after that is the reaction of you feeling bad. So you want to console yourself and finding a reason why you justify your action. But then in underlying thing, actually that action itself is not wholesome because you're feeling bad about it. That is what it means by being honest. If you're not honest, you will come up with many excuses, and then you have layers of excuses. And then you don't see what's the cause and effect, the original cause and effect of your action. Does it make sense? That is why it's hard. If you want to practice really 100%, even 150%, it's not easy. But it's not impossible, because it's just taken effort and courage, and, you know, patience.
What happens to the ones that don't feel bad about that? Or what about the ones that believe?
If you're very sensitive,
right?
maybe, but if you're really sensitive, whatever action that you do with either ill will or bad intention, you'll feel something. The body will tell you, or even the heart itself will tell you. We just need to be in tune with it.
Do you think that maybe people won't feel as bad about it because there's often gossiping about people that you don't actually personally know, but it is like the gossip that you read in the magazines about like these famous people or whatever that you'll never meet. Is it that kind of distance from the person that can, like, mean that maybe, they're not, like, as sensitive or, like, self-reflecting enough, but maybe it's that distance as well that makes people not realize that it's harmful? But,
it may not necessarily harmful for the other person or the subjects of the topic, right?
No, but for themselves.
For themselves? From my personal experience, when I speak ill will of others, there's some level, well, not speak ill will, well, that's the reason why. When I gossip about others, there's some level of ill will within me about that person or about the situation. That's why I want to speak it up. That's why I want to basically, what's the word? Encourage or even, what's the word? Like, I forgot. It was in my mind just then. Anyway, so that is like supporting my ill will, encouraging it. Because when I speak ill about others, it grows, right? So that's why it's harmful. It's best when you have, let's say I don't like a person, it's best just to leave it like that. Because a person maybe, you don't like her now, but she may change in a few months' time. And then you become good friend. Who knows? Nobody knows. So when we fertilize the ill will by speaking bad of that person, actually. So when you speak bad of other person, actually you're encouraging, you're growing more of this ill will or dislike in your heart. So that's why it's harmful for ourselves.
I'm trying to define gossip in my mind. I understand that maybe the articles in the magazine would be more gossip. What about the articles in the newspapers? Now, also, the writers, bear in mind, the journalists, it's sometimes very difficult to take objective views. There's always a bit of subjective views as well in the newspapers. Would that be regarded as gossip, or would that just be more...
I think that helps you with the journalist being biased into one side of the story.
Yeah, I'm just trying to define, like, is that regarded as gossip?
You want to take it?
News. News is a very hard, very big topic. Because...
News.
How often do we see positive news in the news? Yeah, hardly ever. And how often do positive things happen, and how often do negative things happen? Like inspiring things, how often do they happen?
Not as often.
That's your perception because of the news that you've been reading are negative.
So the news itself is already a certain presentation of our world, right?
Yeah.
And that presentation, as Kaichung said, is biased in some way towards negativity. And then we ask the question, why? Why? Because positive news won't sell.
That's right. But why negative news sell?
Yeah, why?
So when you said individual, do you mean the person that is reading or
So the friends who are talking about so-and-so having an affair with so-and-so, like about the magazine, and at least our husband's not doing that. That kind of thing. So making them feel good.
comparing to another person.
But then, must we always feel good when someone else is bad?
No, I'm just saying, like, do you, if that is the motivation for a lot of people, what makes that not right?
By making others, like, because by comparing ourselves, we need someone to be worse than us before we can be better than them, in a way. So, in a way, you are sort of, you might say bad things about someone to make yourself feel good, so in a way you're hurting their reputation as well. Although you might not hurt the actual person, but you might be hurting their reputation. And then, as people know, words travel fast. So you might be saying that, so-and-so is late to this meeting. But then someone else might, like when you tell a friend, so-and-so is late to a meeting, that friend might tell another friend, so-and-so didn't come for the meeting at all. So, like, that's how fast the words can separate from the original meaning. Anyway, so you might not notice that small little gossip that you mentioned might create such a huge problem for that person. Yeah.
I think, Ricky Lee, you're talking like about celebrities, for example, right?
Yeah, but I think that still can apply.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, the more people are. If the gossip is traveling, and then the more negative story is going to be written about them, and you know they might be exposed to them, and even though it's not like a person, you've got like that medium that's accessible for everyone between you. So yeah, no, I understand. That makes sense.
And with technology these days, it's so easy. I'd like to also mention. You mentioned ego. As well, in like if something boosts your ego, I think we've touched upon like conceit, the area of conceit. So it's very interesting that conceit in Buddhism, there's three types of conceit, and all three don't have positive consequences. And if any type of speech boosts conceit, then that already is kind of harmful. So conceit in Buddhism is thinking that you're above people, which is what usually we see as conceit, like arrogance. Thinking that, but then there's also thinking that you're below people is a type of conceit. And the other one, which we all think is, which is probably the strangest one, is thinking that we're the same as others, is the third type of conceit. So all these types of conceit aren't beneficial, because this is very, very...
Very deep.
So, for example, what do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah,
of the conceit?
Yeah. Where are you? Yeah. Just up and above.
Yeah. I think what was advised and what I think is that instead of thinking of your comparing, everyone is unique. So there's no the same, worse, or better. And that way generates respect for everyone. And that's how we can live with all our differences and still have peace, harmony, and love in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we'd like to, we can focus on, I'm better than this, I'm worse at this, and that's what creates conflict. Whereas embracing is, you know, embracing uniqueness, being open. That's...
So
what breaks barriers?
So we're not the same, but we have something in common, which is that we're all unique.
Yeah.
Nicely put.
The thing is, conceit is an object of the mind, right? It doesn't mean, like... Of course, we're the same on some level. Like, physically, we're very similar. DNA-related, very similar. How do you say that? Genetically, we're very similar. But conceit is on the level of the mind, so it's how we view others. So if I think I'm a physics student, I'm better than biology students, then that's conceit. Whereas we're both human, or we're both Asian, that's not really, yeah. Unless I take it to define how I look at things, that's not really conceit. Thank you.
to
I think my understanding is just don't compare yourself.
Sorry.
I think my understanding is just don't compare yourself to others. And that would mean you would be above the level.
What about the like being inspired by others? Because that, in a way, that's kind of seeing, looking up to someone in a way, and like aspiring to be a bit more like them.
Yeah.
In whatever kind of characteristics, like obviously not as a whole person, but yeah, like obviously it's good to be inspired.
Yeah,
right,
definitely.
That's right.
Yes, it is. Like, for example, we look up to the Buddha in
yes.
practicing the way to peace. But do we put ourselves down? That's the conceit part. Yeah.
I think the key point here is the sense of self. Because in Buddhism, we believe, well, not we believe, in Buddhism, there's this call of non-self, of anatta. So Buddhism don't say that individually we have this self, not denying that there is an existence of me or my body or my mind. It's just saying that there is no permanent entity. So things happen because of causes and effect. Things happen because of there's causes and condition. And why we behave certain way, also there's a cause and there's a condition behind it. How we think, how we look, even, there's a causes and condition behind it. And these causes and condition, they are changing. So how can we say that there is one permanent entity? How can I say me at this time is the same person as me 1 year ago? It's different person. So there is no a real solid entity. So we're all changing because it's nature. So that's the whole idea why conceit is because we believe there's this sense of permanent self. But in fact, there is no permanent self. So, yeah, that's my point.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, they say our bodies change every 5 years.
Maybe, yeah, yeah. And the cell in the body changes too.
So coming back to
right,
gossip. I think we've covered gossip, you know. Harsh speech. So there's two left, harsh speech and idle talk. I think we'll talk about idle talk first because it's more closely related to gossip. So what is idle talk? It's basically meaningless and leading. Do you want? How can you go? Didn't even have to ask. So idle talk is something like, for example, oh, do you know that the iPhone 6 is coming out? Are you thinking of getting it? You know, my iPhone 5 is getting a bit old. 5S. What is it? 5C? 5S? I don't know. Yeah, it's something like that. Something that leads to desires or leads to aversion or ill will. And also, you may notice that, I don't know if you have noticed, but if you've been on a sort of a retreat where you don't talk, you notice how much energy speaking takes, especially constant speaking throughout the day. So part of practicing not idle chatter is it conserves energy for the mind to be more clear. And that's the center of the practice. If you don't have a clear mind, then how can we even practice anything on the path?
Yep.
Anything to add?
Sorry, I keep asking questions. Please, anyone else? What about small talk? Because I feel like Australian culture as well, quite big on small talk, and you notice a lot of people who might be lonely or something like that, and so they, you know, like they just want to kind of have that perhaps meaningless conversation with a puppy boy or anyone in a cafe or something, but it's like it seems meaningless because it's just like, oh, what about the weather, but it's meaningful in the sense that it's just people engaging with each other and having a nice interaction.
Yeah, sure, that is.
So then in that case, because it's not leading to the
Ill will.
So then that's not really the same as idle talk.
No, I don't
because
think
it
so.
Is fulfilling a kind of.
If it serves the purpose, then it's not idle talk.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you come into work and say hi to everyone, how are you? You know, that's producing positive vibes. That's, and you have the, if you have the intention of, you know, establishing a good working relationship with people, or just making the morning brighter, then it's definitely not idle talk.
So again, it's more like the intention behind it rather than the actual content of what you're saying.
I think for this, you need to define what bright means.
I thought I did.
He did. Anything that is conducive.
Sort of like the intention. So then, does everyone know what bright in this sense means?
He just said not harm, right? Not harm.
So for me, what right means is practice that leads to peacefulness, that leads to the goal of nirvana, to liberation. So anything that's not on that path is considered wrong view, wrong speech. So we don't say something's good or bad because that's subjective. But if something is conducive to your practice, then that's right and you should do it.
That's right. Yeah, that's perfectly correct.
Yes.
Another way of looking at it is, yes, indeed, what is conducive for our peaceful peace of mind? Because the whole idea of Buddhist practice is about peacefulness, how to gain this peacefulness in the mind. So anything that is right or skillful is always peaceful. The effect of the action is always peaceful. So that's one way of checking ourselves when we've done things wholesomely or unwholesome. So when we do something good, there's this sense of joy, peacefulness, happiness in the mind. But when you do something bad, you feel contraction, conflict, or even heaviness in the mind, or you basically can't be peaceful. You can't be you don't feel the joy, you don't feel happiness. Then you know there's something that you've done or you've thought or you've said is unwholesome. So that's one way of looking at it. And what Alan said is also correct. That is harmful for others and harmful for ourselves is not right. But when it's not harmful for others and not harmful for ourselves, then it's right. Because when it's harmful, then you won't have that peace of mind. But when it's not harming anyone, there's a loving kindness intention behind it, then it will be conducive for the mind, or for the peacefulness of the mind. So yeah, both of you are right. Continue on.
Oh, the last one is harsh speech. So harsh is just something that's not said very nicely. So something that's, I think, in the sutras, it's something else, painful to the ear, or something along the lines of painful to the listener's ears. So, funnily enough, if you say the truth when it will be painful to others, then that is also harsh speech. So, practicing the Dharma isn't just saying the truth whenever we have to say the truth, because this is the practice, but it's finding the right time and having the right intention, and also saying it in the right way. So harsh speech is also is both in the content of our speech and in the way we speak, that doesn't harm or that harms people. That's harsh speech. Yeah.
I don't know what was around when Buddha was around, but what about in the conventional kind of court of law setting, where it might be necessary for like a witness to say something that will hurt one or the other side of the case, but it's, you know, for the case of justice.
So if you testify
robbery or something,
yeah,
and it's a down and out teenager who's being accused of this robbery, I don't know if this would be an actual court case, but and you're there and you have to tell the truth, but you can see that it's going to hurt this person because they're going to be punished.
I see
for
where you're
it.
Coming from now. Okay. So you're saying that as a witness, you're obliged to say the truth. But by saying the truth, it might be harming the other person, the suspect, or whoever done the crime.
Yeah.
I guess that comes back to the duty, right? As a witness, your duty is to tell what you saw, what you believe, what you think is true. Then you sign up for it, then perform your duty. It's your responsibility as a witness to tell the truth. You can't cover the truth, because if you do that, then justice doesn't work. So we play by the law, right? So basically we're in the society. So law plays a big part in our society. And we have to abide the law, otherwise you'll get consequences that you don't like. Similarly, when somebody has done crime, well, it's not nice to put the person into jail, but since the system is done this way, then whatever your responsibility is, then you have to perform it. Your intention is not coming from wanting this person or the criminal to be in jail, but your intention is to perform what you are supposed to do. If you can bring the justice, then why not? Right? Well, that's my opinion anyway. Yeah.
And going back to your question, what would the Buddha think? On my trip to India, we went to the largest monastery at the time of the Buddha. So he was residing there. And there was a court for the monks. And in the middle of the court, there was this big well. So the Buddha did lay down rules for his monks. And there were serious consequences if they broke the rules. And then they would have witnesses as well. But then afterwards, everyone would accept it. They would accept it, and then they would forgive each other. And they would write the case on a piece of paper and throw it down the well as a symbolism of forgetting it, letting go of everything. So yeah, that's what the Buddha would do. Yeah.
Mm.
So it's to harmonize the society and community. So it's a communal effort to forgive, to have loving kindness.
Mm. But then, yeah, and I guess the you can see like the difference between us, like kind of holding onto that idea of a permanent self who can then be punished, go to jail because you've done a bad thing, therefore you're being bad, as opposed to that which is something bad has happened, like someone was responsible, you got or dumb to it now, like that's kind of punishment enough, and then you just move on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, everyone changes, and you're giving like that kind of benefit of the doubt as opposed to what we do.
It's encouraging growth. It's encouraging growth. Yeah, that's
consistent. It's like individuals are practicing Buddhism, and you're called up for jury duty. I'm interested to know what happens, because usually you have to have a very worthy case to put forward why you're not going to be on jury duty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happens when you're an individual practicing Buddhism and that does happen?
I think you just have to be objective as possible, as much as you can.
So do you know anyone who has been called?
Yeah, I've known a friend who's done a jury duty, and she's a practicing Buddhist as well, and she was saying it's really hard.
Must be.
It's really hard.
Especially if you're in a case and it's a murder.
That's right. That's right. I think the one that she's just gone through was one of quite a substantial one. And she was saying that if she has a choice, she doesn't want to sit in the jury seat. But sometimes you don't have a choice. When you don't have a choice, then you do your best, right? With whatever facts you're given, evidence that you're given, you do your best. Maybe it's not the best, but at least you tried to do as much as you can.
So you need to bring the meditation into the courtroom.
Yeah, try to see more objective. That's right. Try to read people's body language, whether the person is lying or not. Try to read underlying message from the judges or not from the lawyers. But it's tough because the system is not about whether the person commits a crime, but whether it's beyond doubt that the person commits a crime. So it's not always 100% that the person has committed the crime, but whether the evidences and the witnesses given gives a beyond reasonably doubt that the person actually commits the crime. So there's no black and white in the court.
So does Buddha Buddha then obviously respects that choice that's made in the community, and even though you might have to make not a nice decision with the jury, then obviously that's all forgiven. Is it? Is it? You know, how heavy it is? I mean, I'm not sure how it works in the Buddha side. When you're looking at all these beautiful positivity side, and that's not a positivity a lot of times. So, as a practice, somebody practicing, how do you release it all, and how does Buddha accept what has been given to you in society, not in your belief, but in society for you to go ahead and do? Because, it is something that,
it's a system in the society,
in lots of ways.
I don't know.
I don't think I would like to be in that position myself.
Yeah.
Have a beautiful outlook and things, every creation around you is beautiful, and then to walk into that, which is not it's not a beautiful creation. So I wonder how that hurts the soul, and how you then come to Buddha and have that forgiveness, because it would have to be some sort of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, as I said, there's a trial, and say for starters, it is somebody that has murdered somebody, and it's a life that's taken, and another life that's going to be taken, whichever way you look at it, putting them away for their whole life, or as America does, the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
I just sort of wonder how you have all this being around you, and how you're to accept that situation.
that you're put in the position as a jury.
That you're part of.
Yeah, you're part of that decision making.
How do you walk away from it?
It's tough, isn't it? Because especially when you're doubtful about your own decision. If you're doubtful about whether you've done the right or wrong thing, then of course it's going to be even harder. But then if you've done the best that you could, as much as you know, as much as you understand of the case, and you believe what you've said or what you think is right, then I think that's the best you can do. That's
see, I
it.
Have a choice, and do you know what I would have to do?
Mm-hmm.
I would have to lock me up because I could not be part of the jury.
You can.
Because I would not want to be a part of that.
That's so your choice, right?
Yeah. But that's what I would choose. I would not want to be part of that jury for something very ugly.
Correct.
I would rather keep my beauty and you'll just have to lock me up for, you know, it would be reversed. I would actually be also the victim. But the victim only in society. But I don't feel I would be a victim in my own mind or in the mind of whatever.
I know what you mean. I know where you're coming from.
I mean, if you're not going to do it, if you're just going to push that responsibility to someone else, then what if that someone else makes a decision that's even less favourable to the actual witness? I mean, that's also something that you might have to bear with as well, as opposed to you giving it your best try and then, like, using whatever you know to actually make that decision.
But it's not what you know. It's a jury.
Yeah, like
a group of people all together.
Yeah.
And it may not even be you that gets to choose. It can be that there's eight out of ten of you that has chosen this other path. So you don't get to say, you know, I don't see it as a free will, free experience, something that I would walk away from, especially if the victim is found guilty and they're not guilty. Do you know
maybe,
experience?
Maybe that's when you...
And it might not always be the case because...
But we wouldn't think that's stupid to go and put yourself in contempt where, okay, well, throw her inside there, you know, or would it be that, well, you should just do what, you know, jury duty does, convict whether you're guilty or not half the time.
Maybe you need to decide for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then be okay with that and put yourself first, right?
Well, like what you said to bring your meditation into the courtroom.
Well, I would love to see that. Where, like, I that's mean, right. You would have this. It would be an amazing place to be. You know, they always say that in the world, if each one of us was to meditate for 1 minute, how beautiful would it be to have world peace?
Yeah.
Each one of us just to do something as simple as that. I love that.
I think, yeah, it's a very, in that situation, it'd be a very personal decision.
Yeah.
And the key is to keep your personal practice with you. So whichever decision you make.
It has all the right view, it has the thoughts, it has the actions, it has speech, the livelihood, the effort, the mindfulness, and that concentration. It's a bit, yeah, and yet the situation.
It's definitely not black and white.
It's not always
be
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of life. That's life. That's the first noble truth.
Life is suffering. The whole idea of life is suffering is not that suffering in a bad way, like, you know, like what it means, sad or depressing. Life is suffering basically means that nothing is satisfactory in life. Even the good stuff will go away. The bad stuff will go away too. So nothing stays the same, because nothing stays the same. Nothing can satisfy you 100%. You can get a new iPhone, for example, and you feel happy about it, but for how long? It will go away too. So nothing is satisfactory. So that's what it means by life is suffering. It's not that life is depressing. Of course, there will be depressing moments. But at the same time, there will be happy moments. Things are never the same. That's what all it means. And because of that, then nothing is ideal. Life is not perfect. Because nothing can satisfy you, then it can't be perfect. If it is perfect, then it will always satisfy you. But because it's not, then it's not perfect. And that's why sometimes in life we have to make difficult choices. We have to make difficult decisions. Because it's imperfect. We're not living in a perfect society. We're not living in a perfect country. Even the weather is not perfect. Now it's supposedly to be spring, but it's freezing like winter. So, yeah, a lot of things we think that we're in control. But most of the time, we're not in control. I can say 99% is not within our control. Nothing we can control. So, that is life.
Yeah, but the Buddha's advice to that suffering, life is suffering, is to understand suffering. So not to try to get rid of it or run away from it, but understand it, which means that he said 99% of our total suffering is within our control. So it comes from the mind. And about 1% is not within our control. And he used the simile, because the Buddha was born as a prince and a warrior, he used a lot of warrior similes. So he's the simile of being struck by arrows. So the first arrow is the arrow of suffering, which is the first noble truth, the suffering that is life, that uncertainty, that unsatisfactoriness. And the second arrow is the suffering that we add on top of that suffering, which is taking this suffering to be ours, which is wanting from the world what it can never give us. And that's desire, that's hatred, that's ill will. And that's most of our suffering, which is why he said that enlightenment is the highest happiness, because you're removing that arrow. You've got one left. Yeah. Like your body can still fall sick and you'll still have some form of suffering, but that is so minute compared to the suffering that we put on ourselves.
So the first arrow is basically old age, sickness and death. That one, everyone will have to have it. No one that will escape death. No one can escape sickness. No one can escape old age. If they can grow old, then they wouldn't be able to escape aging. So basically, that's the first arrow. But the second arrow is what we add on to it. How we react to it. How we react to our sickness. How we react to our life. That is the second arrow. Right?
Yep. So we've covered the four areas of you could say wrong speech, or speech that isn't beneficial, isn't skillful. But the Buddha did prescribe, just quickly, because we're almost out of time, he did prescribe a formula for conducive speech or beneficial speech. And just in brief, I think we've already covered it throughout our discussions, but just in brief, firstly, it starts with the intention. So what is the intention of what you're going to say? Secondly, timing. Timing is very important, because saying something that might be, yeah, might have the right intention, but I think we all know from experience, saying something at the wrong time, wrong place, yeah, that will have negative consequences, even though it might be true, and you might be saying it nicely with the correct intention. And then the next thing is saying it nicely. So the way that we deliver our message, and, oh, this should be at the front, the truth. So something that's true.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite of harsh speech, gossip, idle talk, and lying. And that's what he advised could be conducive to the practice, would create harmony, and create good and positive relationships with others, because we live in connection with others, obviously. So does anyone have any questions or anything else they'd like to discuss?
I think one thing that is also important is to take note of what's the chatter inside the mind. How do you talk to yourself? Do you talk to yourself with a lot of negativity? Or do you, you know, keep an eye on what you think? What's the behavior of the thinking? What's your habitual tendency when you think? Because you might be surprised to find that sometimes we don't talk nice about ourselves or to ourselves. We don't talk nice. We criticize ourselves really harshly sometimes. You put a lot of expectation about yourself, and when you don't meet that expectation, you punish yourself by saying bad things about yourself. So keep an eye on those, because you'd be surprised when you think like that or when you talk to yourself like that, you tend to project it the same way to others as well. Subconsciously, that's how we do. We think about ourselves like that, like let's say you have expectation, such a high expectation on yourself, and you don't meet the expectation, and you punish yourself by saying bad things about yourself, or you're stupid, blah, blah, blah. And you tend to react this similarly towards others when they don't meet your expectation about what you expect of them. So,
and then it's like the people closest to you that you like take it out on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, because Buddha just has everything that every single person wants. Unconditional love. Now. Right now. And that's what we all work towards, I suppose. So, yeah. I think.
But things don't happen instantly, though.
No, we can
aspire to
make it.
Yeah, we can aspire to be there.
You know, I can go to lunch and eat if I wanted to, or I could choose to go to the gym and do a benefit for my body.
Yeah.
So that's what I choose to do. So yeah, that's right. It's a challenge daily, but I kind of like that. But as I said, we are reaching for the same love. Well, that's what we all want, don't we? It's got to be everything about our everyday life.
Mm.
The negativity side, though, I think as children we didn't probably have it. I think we just all learnt as we, I don't know, the gossip came into our world and that. But then it's actually what everybody wants again anyway, is to have that. And, it's nice being in a room full of every individual that we are, but we're all on that same path, or that same wavelength, which is that you want to hear. And the vibes are always good.
Mm.
Like last Saturday, I just loved it. It's like the vibrations were just amazing.
Mm.
Just, really good to be part of it. So, yeah.
Yeah, good job. They've done a great job, I think. Fantastic. Yeah, I agree. Awesome.
Last Saturday was Bodhi night. It was our annual performance night, where we celebrate Unibud's anniversary and with a performance, and also includes Dharma talks. So we try to portray Buddhism through a interesting and fun way. Was anyone not at Bodhi night? Oh.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, body night. It's cool. Any question? Mm. Any burning question? Even not related to speech? Anything? We've got 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, and to expand on Rosie's last point, I did have something. So, the inner speech. I think I told this to some of my friends who are here. So, one interesting way of producing more, just a little bit more happiness in our daily lives is to make an extra effort to speak nicely to yourself. And one of the most convenient times to do that is right before you sleep and when you wake up, which is wishing yourself good night and wishing yourself good morning. It's really simple, and no, I tried it, which is, and it works. Like telling yourself good night, me, before you go to sleep. In a not like, oh, good night, me, but in a positive tone, and really mean it, actually works, helps you get to sleep. And telling yourself good morning when you wake up, not out loud, but well, you can do it out loud if you wish. But either way. And smiling at yourself in the mirror, something really simple like that actually can help you to bring your energy up. You can feel the energy, because that's the energy of positivity.
My mother has every day always been that sort of that person. Well, she is that person, and she has always good morning and always thank you. Always, she starts her day every day.
Hmm.
And always a smile on her face continuously.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. It's good. Give it to me.
Yeah, so there's always opportunities to be able to share positive energy with others and with yourself.
Mm. Agree.
She's always smiling.
Yeah. Kind of weird. I always smile.
So if no one has any questions, we'll wrap up for today. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Rosie.
Thank you.